Senator Tammy Duckworth joins us today to talk about her first bill successfully passing, her first speech from the Senate floor, as well as her thoughts on President Trump's budget proposals, transportation infrastructure, and jobs.
That's what we need to build in this country, is that skilled technical workforce. You know, we built this nation in the 20th century with it. We need to reinvest for the 21st century.
Also, we go far back into Illinois' history, 131 years to be precise, to discuss the Haymarket affair that occurred this week, 131 years ago, and how it forever changed not just the city of Chicago and Illinois, but the labor movement.
The idea that an eight-hour day is just a kind of given thing and that we've accepted that, that's not true. People had to really sort of, you know, struggle and persist in order to achieve even that.
And we talk about its parallels with today. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, Illinois freshman Senator Tammy Duckworth had a busy one. Not only did she deliver her first address to the Senate floor, but her first ever Senate bill, rolling back an Obama-era regulation on transportation planning, successfully also passed in the House. This week, she's been speaking out about President Trump's pick to head the Selective Service. I caught up with Senator Duckworth yesterday afternoon. Senator, welcome back to the 21st.
It's great to be on. Thank you.
President Trump's budget, I wanted to ask you about that. You know, some have referred to his original ideas as a skinny budget, but now there's an actual spending plan that's been put forward. What are you most concerned about?
Well, the budget for next year, which is not what we're voting on this week, but the budget for next year, the skinny plan that the president has put out, eliminates significant items. For example, it's almost a 30% cut to the Department of Agriculture, which will really negatively affect our farmers across Illinois. Everything from support for agriculture all the way through to clean water for rural communities is significantly cut in that plan. I just think it's really irresponsible.
I wanted to ask you about the transportation infrastructure bill that passed in the House last week. It was something that the Senate had passed earlier. Why did you focus on that as one of your first legislative efforts?
Well, transportation and infrastructure is critical to Illinois and to the nation. Studies show that we need at least $1 trillion in infrastructure investment just to get to a point where our bridges and our roads and our railways are up to standard. You know, we have many bridges and roads and railways and then all across the state that are suboptimal, but people are still using them. And so we need at least $1 trillion in investments. And this is a way to get jobs coming into our local economy. We have everything from the bypass around Decatur and the intermodal facility there all the way through to faster rail lines from Chicago through Springfield down into St. Louis to bridges on the Mississippi with the Merchants Bridge project that will help barges bring our corn and soybean to market. So this is really critical on all levels, you know, road, rail, waterways, airports, that's really going to be critical to our economy in Illinois.
Now, you and Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen had a video you put out around President Trump's 100th day. This is speaking of jobs. You were just talking about that, calling President Trump out for not supporting American manufacturing regarding the building of the Keystone Pipeline. Mm-hmm. Is building the pipeline something that you supported in the past?
No, you know, my position on the pipeline is that we needed a better deal for Americans. I always felt that it was for Canadian oil profits going back to a Canadian company that then the oil would get sold to China. I always thought that if there were any type of a deal that we'd create more jobs in the United States and dollars here in the U.S., I would, you know, be able to support it. Bottom line, the pipeline is a fact. It's happening. But that said, we need to make sure we get the best deal for Americans as possible, and that means that it should be built using American steel. Instead, you know, President Trump went back on his campaign promise. One of the first things he said was to exempt both the Keystone and the Dakota Pipeline from using American-made steel. And in fact, it will be using steel from India and from Russia. In fact, from a Russian company run by a man whose wife was Ivanka Trump's special guest to the inauguration. This is not what we need. We need to get those jobs down to Granite City, Illinois, reopen our steel mills, and let's get those good American jobs back again.
One other thing you've been focusing on in terms of jobs is youth unemployment. I know that when we're looking at the number of unemployed and out of school, we're thinking about young people aged 20 to 24. That's about 17% in Illinois. In Chicago, it's even higher. This is this deep systemic problem that I know lots of people have talked about for years. What do you, and I know you're working with Senator Dick Durbin on this, how do you propose helping solve this problem?
One of the ways that I propose to solve the problem of youth unemployment is my Community College to Career Technical Education Act. It's something that I've introduced with Senator Franken from Minnesota. And what it will do is set up a grant program so that manufacturers can work with local community colleges to set up programs for technical education that would result in a job with that manufacturer. So, for example, you could have a local company that would help fund a tuition-free two-year degree program at a local community college so that a young person can enter that program, not have to pay tuition, get a good education with all of the training that they need to get a job in that business. And the business, on the other hand, gets to have an employee that has been trained in exactly what they need in order to go to work on day one with a good paying job. You know, when you talk to manufacturers, the National Manufacturing Association did a study and asked what the biggest problem their manufacturers were facing that was keeping them from growing. And you would have thought they would have said, you know, foreign competition, cheap foreign labor. No, what they said was lack of a skilled workforce. And that's what we need to build in this country is that skilled technical workforce that we have. You know, we built this nation in the 20th century with it. We need to reinvest for the 21st century.
Senator, you delivered your so-called maiden speech on the Senate floor last week, which you did, by the way, I understand from the desk that Barack Obama used to use when he was senator. Is that correct?
Yes, it's also Paul Simon's desk, and I'm very proud of that. The first day, these desks, they're pretty funny.
Wow, there's a lot of history there.
There's a lot of history in that desk. It was also Barbara Mikulski, the first woman elected on her own to the United States Senate from Maryland. It was her desk at one point. But they all scratched their names into the drawer like you did in elementary school, and a little bit of graffiti in there. When I opened it up, there was Paul Simon's signature, and in his very Paul Simon way, he actually put Illinois next to his name as if he had to explain who he was. And yes, it was Barack Obama's desk as well, and it was Barbara Mikulski. So I'm very proud to get to sit at that desk.
Right. And of course, you're no stranger to speaking on congressional floors. But I wonder, when you're preparing for your Senate speech, did you approach things differently? Did you prepare differently?
Well, I did. You know, it's in the House, you only speak for 2, maybe 5 minutes at the most.
Right, and this was 22 minutes, right?
This was 22 minutes. Nowhere near as long as some people's maiden speeches, many of whom have gone on for well over an hour historically. But 20 minutes is an awful long time. And I wanted to talk about the strength of my nation. I wanted to talk about the investments we made in America in the past and how we need to make those investments well into the future on things like infrastructure, things like education, things like our military, to make sure that America continues to lead the free world.
That's Senator Tammy Duckworth on the line with us from Washington, D.C. Senator Duckworth, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Hundred and 31 years ago this week, Chicago workers went on strike for an 8-hour workday and to protest the deaths of several workers at the hands of police. And when officers moved in to break up a protest, someone threw a bomb. At least 4 civilians were killed, along with 7 police officers, dozens wounded as well. This became known as the Haymarket Affair, and it forever changed not just the labor movement, but the city of Chicago and world history. Paul DiRica joins us now. He's a Chicago historian, although his day job is the director of programs at Illinois Humanities. Robert Lurzel is also on the line. He's a Chicago author and freelance journalist. They're going to give us a sense back into what this was like, as well as present parallels for today. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Paul, there's so much to get into here, right? This is a huge, the Haymarket Affair, the Haymarket Incident is such a huge story, and there's so many different pieces of this. But I just wanted to start with, if you could put in context, how important is this in terms of labor history as well as the city of Chicago and Illinois history?
In order to kind of really understand its significance, you have to kind of place it back within the 19th century and kind of understand what was going on in the United States in the decades after the Civil War, there's a whole series of depressions and recessions that makes life very precarious, particularly for working people and for immigrants. And kind of coupled with these kind of economic downturns are kind of moments of civil unrest in which the police and sometimes even the United States military are kind of called into urban centers to restore order. And oftentimes it results in violence with the police directing their fire towards striking workers. So even though today we're going to be talking about a single incident that occurred at the intersection of Randolph and Splaines in Chicago on the 4th of May, 1886, I mean, its ramifications are great.
And when we think about that, as we think about this event, I wonder if you can describe a little bit more about the political climate at the time, as well as, you said, workers. I think we have a sense of what, you know, there are things that perhaps we take for granted today, like an 8-hour workday and things like this. What was it like in the 1880s?
Yeah. So a lot of things that we take as givens today didn't exist. Healthcare provided by an employer, a pension system, child labor laws, a minimum wage, even things like the weekend and the 8-hour workday. Now, Chicago, at the time of the Haymarket bombing in 1886, was like a lot of urban centers. It was rapidly changing to being a city populated primarily by immigrants. And in the late 19th century, the largest ethnic bloc in the city of Chicago were Germans. And you see that reflected in the Haymarket story. A lot of the men who spoke at the rally on the 4th of May were from Germany. But also, you see it in the sort of handbill that was used to kind of draw people to the event. So on the 3rd of May, 20,000 handbills were printed, basically calling people to a rally at Haymarket Square. And half of that handbill is in German, and the lower half is in English. And that's kind of reflective of Chicago being this immigrant city.
That's Paul DiRica. Robert Lurzel is with us as well. Robert did a story for WBEZ Chicago's Curious City about all of this. We'll tweet out that link because it's a really fascinating conversation with lots of people about the context of that. If you're interested in it, our handle is 21st Show. Robert, how were German immigrants viewed in Chicago, in the city, in American culture at the time?
It almost feels like it was a half German city with a lot of Irish and English people of Irish and English heritage there as well. Among the Germans, you had some people who were pretty radical and in favor of things like anarchism and socialism and really, you know, taking the idea of labor unions to what was viewed then as real extreme. But you got plenty of Germans who weren't, you know, on that part of the political spectrum, just everyday people working of various political beliefs. So when you had something like Haymarket happening, you had the radical elements who were becoming sort of the scapegoats for what was going on. And this raised all kinds of criticisms of immigration. You know, as a result of all this happening, there were calls for crackdowns on immigration, where you can see some parallels with what's happening today.
Yeah. Before we get to that, Paul, can you tell us about, Robert mentioned different political groups. Anarchists are going to play a big role in this conversation, right? Because that's who eventually ends up on trial for everything. Before we get to what actually happened, who throws this bomb, what organizations, what political groups at the time were striking? Who were the sort of the players involved with all of this?
Well, there was a real spectrum involved. So the call to kind of make a push for the 8-hour workday was actually made by what became the American Federation of Labor, which today we think of as being a kind of mainstream labor organization. And they sort of set May 1st, 1886 as kind of the day to sort of make a push for the 8-hour workday all the way back in 1884. And so when the 1st of May, 1886 arrives, somewhere between 300,000 to half a million American workers all across the United States, men, women, and children, go on strike to push for the 8-hour workday. And they represent a whole range of immigrant groups. They represent a whole range of political affiliations. In Chicago, there's close to 80,000 by some estimates. Some put it a little bit lower who go on strike. And once again, they kind of represent that sort of diversity in terms of ethnic background, in terms of political allegiance. To give you a sort of illustration of how political opinions and positions can evolve, one of the individuals who spoke at the rally on the 4th of May is a gentleman by the name of Albert Parsons. He was born in the United States, came from a very old family. He could trace his family
back to the Mayflower, had great-grandfathers who'd fought in the Revolutionary War. Originally, during the Civil War, he fought on the side of the Confederacy, but then after the war had a political conversion and became a radical Republican in Texas, sort of basically trying to fight to sort of preserve the rights of the recently emancipated slaves.
Right, because let's remember what the Republican Party was in 1880.
Was back, yeah, right, and right after the post-Civil War. But then he moves to Chicago with his wife, a former slave, Lucy Gonzalez, in the early 1870s, and he stops being a Republican and he becomes a socialist, which is left of center, but a well-established party at that time. And he runs for different city offices, so he runs to be alderman, for example. But as a result of these kind of economic recessions and depressions that I described and the sort of like response by the police to some of this civil unrest, he becomes even more radicalized. So that by the time of the bombing of Haymarket Square, he's an avowed anarchist and a member of a kind of working man's party. So within the sort of space of, you know, about 20 years from the end of the Civil War to the bombing of Haymarket Square, you have one individual who's gone from being involved in a fairly mainstream major political party to being very, very far to the left and kind of calling for the complete sort of eradication of the state as we know it. And I think Parsons gives you a good sense of how kind of volatile political opinions and how varying they could be at that time.
We need to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Paul DeRica and Robert Lorzel talking about the Haymarket affair. It happened happened this week, 131 years ago, and so we're going back into Illinois history, into Chicago history, this event that's had international ramifications. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Hi, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. Right now, we're going way back into Illinois history. We're going back 131 years ago to Haymarket, to Chicago, to the Haymarket affair, the incident. I'm discussing that with public historian, Chicago historian Paul DeRica. He's also the director of programs at Illinois Humanity. He's also on the line from Chicago. Robert Lorzel is with us. He's a Chicago author and freelance journalist. Paul, right before the break, you're sort of talking about the radical movement, the radicalization, if I can use that term. Do you think that's the right term to use for of some of the people who are involved in this? So there's a May 1st protest. Take us up to the events of what happens on May 4th. What happens on there's a protest strike happens on May 1st. What happens in downtown? Well, I guess what had that been downtown Chicago at that point on Randolph and Des Plaines?
It would have been a little bit north of downtown,
okay.
And I can explain kind of why that site was picked. So, as I said, the 1st of May, somewhere between 50 to 80,000 Chicago workers go on strike. They come from all the different ethnic groups in the cities, German, Irish, Scandinavian people. They work in a range of industry. They're men, women, and children. At the time, there's already other strikes that were happening for a variety of reasons. And down at the McCormick Reaper Works, you know, Cyrus McCormick invented the mechanical reaper that was based in Chicago. Well, his son had kind of locked out some of the more skilled workers and replaced them with what would be called sort of scab labor, right? Sort of like replacement labor. And so the former workers were outside the McCormick reaper plant, basically kind of protesting that. And across the street, there were a bunch of lumberyard workers who were going on strike for the hour workday. And they were being addressed by a gentleman named August Spies. August Spies was a German immigrant. He came to the United States, and he started a kind of workers' newspaper. And so he was there basically kind of encouraging the lumbermen to sort of hang together and push for the eight-hour day. Well, the end of the workday comes, the whistle at the McCormick plant sounds, and the sort of scab workers begin to leave the factory where they get into a tussle with the sort of striking workers. Police are called in, the police fire into the crowd of the McCormick workers, and it's believed at that time that about six workers died, although most historians now think that maybe it was at most two. Spies witnesses all of this, and he's horrified. So he decides to go back to his newspaper office, and since he runs a newspaper, it makes it very easy for him to print up flyers. And so after consulting with some of his associates, many of whom are really kind of radical people, right? Socialists, but also anarchists. He decides to basically kind of hold a protest meeting on the 4th of May in Haymarket Square. And the reason that he picked that is because the Haymarket area was kind of the sort of wholesale area in the city. It was a big, wide open area where you could bring a lot of people in and kind of hold a rally successfully. So he calls this rally for the next day, the 4th of May, 1886. He prints out 20,000 of these handbills that get distributed all across the city. And at that time, right, this whole thing is just being thrown together. So he doesn't even know who's going to speak at it. The actual handbill just says good speakers will be there to kind of address what had happened at the McCormick plant. He knows he's going to be one of the speakers, but he expects to talk last and address the crowd in German because he expects that there'll be a large kind of German-speaking audience. So he shows up there on the evening of the 4th of May. There's anywhere between 2,000 to 3,000 people who have gathered, and he's horrified to learn that his friends haven't actually found any speakers. So the meeting's starting a little bit late. Nobody's there to kind of hold the crowd together. So he decides first to kind of shift the location a little bit from Randolph Street onto Desplaines, an area that's a little bit more protected and also a little bit more removed from the police station that's just about a block south on Desplaines. And he basically sends his friends off to find other speakers. So Spies ends up talking to the audience actually in English for about 30 minutes. And in that time, his friends are able to find two other speakers, Albert Parsons, who, as I mentioned, was a labor leader, who had gone all the way from being a kind of mainstream Republican to being a violent anarchist, and another gentleman by the name of Samuel Fielden, who was an English immigrant and also a former Methodist minister and preacher, who was there to kind of address the crowd. So Spies talks for about 30 minutes. Parsons, who's a very gifted orator, gets up on the wagon and addresses the crowd for about 90 minutes straight, just off the cuff. And then Fielden gets on the wagon last to kind of talk to the group. By now, it's almost 10:30 at night. It's between 10 and 10:30. The day is overcast. It looks like it's going to rain any minute. And the crowd has dwindled to about 300. Now, mixed into the crowd in Haymarket Square is the mayor of Chicago himself, a guy by the name of Carter Harrison. Harrison's observing everything. It seems like it's going to be a peaceful rally to kind of protest what had happened at the McCormick work, Reaper Works. And so he goes that block south to the police station where there's between 170 and 180 police officers ready to march up at the Haymarket Square and break up the rally should that be required. The mayor says, you can send all the boys home to the commanding officer because it looks like the meeting is breaking up on its own. The mayor starts to head back to his house, but before he can even get there, he hears a loud bang. And what has happened? Well, the moment the mayor leaves Haymarket Square, the commanding officers, William Ward and John Bonfield, order their officers to march into Haymarket Square. They confront Fielden, who's on the wagon right then, sort of addressing the crowd, telling him to disperse the group. Fielden says it's a peaceful rally. And at that moment, somebody steps out from the crowd. And to this day, historians don't know exactly who that individual was. And that person throws a bomb into the center of the police's ranks. One officer dies instantly. Ultimately, eight officers will die as a result of the wounds that they sustain. All of the officers had handguns on them. So the moment the bomb goes off, they also start firing as well. The whole incident lasts about 15 minutes. But as I said, about eight officers lose their lives. It's unknown how many of the strikers were wounded or who die as a result of their wounds. And then ultimately, eight men are brought to trial in connection with the bombing.
Yeah. So, Robert, I wonder if you can step in here and say, so they never figured out who threw the bomb, but who are these eight people who end up on trial?
Well, they were basically the speakers and other associates who were connected with the anarchist movement. But the big controversy here was that these men on trial were not even accused of throwing the bomb.
Some of them weren't even there, right?
Well, and some of them had been there at various points during the evening, but some of them weren't even there or hadn't been there at all during the night. So the idea was that they were all part of this conspiracy. It's that either had, you know, they either had plotted to have this bomb thrown and have this attack on the police, or that their speeches had provoked this kind of action. It's kind of the prosecution is sort of making the equivalent of argument of that, you know, this was not protected speech of what they're doing because they were provoking people into acts of subversion and violence. but they were being charged with murder. So it was a very controversial, it still is very controversial from, among historians, this idea of prosecuting them for this. And this is where the heart of the debate that still goes on over Haymarket is about this trial and what happened with these men.
What does happen with these men, Paul? Because this does become this really. So there's the incident. Would you say that the trial, from a historical context, the trial and the aftermath almost end up overshadowing what actually happened?
I would say so, but we also have to keep in mind what actually happened. So here we are about 20-some years removed from the Civil War and all of the sort of violence and devastation that attended that. But what happened on that night in Chicago was unprecedented because you had a single person who could hold a single small device in his hand, throw it into the crowd, and kind of wreak this kind of havoc. And so people were scared, right? And when they got scared, they closed ranks and they went after anybody that they could attach blame to. And that's how those eight men ended up on trial. And public opinion was very much against them in the beginning. But as the trial went on and concluded, and all but one of the eight were sentenced to die, one of them, who had very little to do with the incident, was sent off to prison, but to a life term, I want to add. But in the aftermath, between the sort of sentencing and then the appeals process, public opinion begins to shift slightly. So that by the time that the men have exhausted their appeals and the execution date is set for the 11th of November, 1887, there are many people who realize that maybe there's been a rush to judgment and that maybe there were some problems with the trial. So what ends up happening is some of the men are encouraged to write to the then governor of Illinois asking for clemency. And two of them do, and they receive life sentences in prison. Another decides that he doesn't want the state to take his life. So on the eve of the execution, he commits suicide in his cell in a very sort of dramatic fashion.
Wow, yeah.
A friend of his managed to sort of smuggle in a dynamite fulminating cap,
which he
sort of sticks into his mouth like a cigar and lights it up.
It's amazing that he somehow managed to get an explosive into the jail.
That's true.
He smuggled a stick of dynamite into jail. But then that's what he uses to commit suicide?
That's what he uses to commit suicide. He was the youngest person put on trial. So he was 24 when he went on trial and 25 when he took his own life. And then the following day, the four other men are put to death. And keep in mind that these are all family men. They're not allowed to see their families before they die. Two of them are people who had spoken that night, Parsons and Spies, who I talked about earlier. Others are just people who are kind of associated with the labor movement and with anarchism in the city. And so after the execution, the bodies are returned to the families, and there's a huge funeral in what is today the sort of Wicker Park neighborhood of Chicago that thousands attend. Before the bodies of the five dead men are taken to a cemetery outside Chicago. And that becomes a kind of rallying point for labor, right? And the memory of these men become a kind of rallying point for labor. And that's why, you know, starting in 1889, but really, you know, crystallizing in 1904, that's how the 1st of May becomes a kind of like labor holiday the world round, right? And these men, known as the sort of Chicago anarchists, while they're on trial, become the sort of Chicago martyrs to the kind of larger labor movement globally.
And if I could jump
go
in
ahead,
here,
Robert. Yeah.
So, you know, and the postscript here, which is also very important, is that you know, after these hangings, you're left with three of the men who are still in prison, and then a new governor comes into office, a German American named John Peter Altgeld, and he pardons the remaining three prisoners, and puts out this scathing statement about the miscarriage of justice that had happened. And this becomes a big flashpoint. The newspapers roundly condemn Altgeld as this, you know, radical demagogue because he's pardoned these men. So that becomes a huge controversy.
Mm-hmm. And it effectively ends Altgeld's career as well.
Yeah. So this is fascinating. I'm speaking with Paul DiRica, a Chicago historian, and Robert Lorzel, a Chicago journalist, about the Haymarket affair. Guys, we just have a couple minutes left, and I have to talk about today, right? Because I feel like you can't have this conversation without looking at it in present day context. And I wonder, Paul, how you think what the Haymarket affair tells us about what sort of what the parallels are today, what the lasting impacts of it are, and the way that we view labor, the way that we view, why don't you do labor, and then Robert, you can talk about sort of the way that we view immigrants as well. Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of how we view labor, I mean, Haymarket remains very, very relevant. As Robert alluded to, even 103 years later, this is still considered a very kind of controversial event based on one's own kind of position and attitudes. I mean, I guess what I'd like to say, I mean, to me, the biggest lesson about Haymarket is this idea that, like, nothing is a given, right? Today, a lot of us work more than 40 hours a week. But the idea that an eight-hour day is just a kind of given thing and that we've accepted that, that's not true. People had to really sort of, you know, struggle and persist in order to achieve even that. And that means that it can be taken away. And then, in, you know, the last several years, right, we've seen a really sort of concentrated attack on organized labor in particular. I would just say kind of working people in general. And a lot of these things that we've kind of regarded as given have been sort of taken away or eroded. That said, the Haymarket story can also serve as an inspiration because these people were able to achieve a lot of things, right? And eventually we did get an eight-hour work day, and we did get child labor laws, and we did get pension plans and all the other things I talked about a little bit earlier in this segment. So on the one hand, Haymarket in regard to labor should serve as a warning to everybody that things that we think are stable and secure can, of course, be removed. But it also should serve as an inspiration that people can, by kind of coming together and kind of pushing for change, kind of achieve a better and more just world.
Yeah, Robert, what do you think in terms of, especially about immigrants? That's something I know you wanted to weigh in on.
Yeah, well, I've been doing some research on this recently, and it's striking how in the days right after Haymarket, people, including some congressmen from Chicago, raised concerns about radical immigrants coming to the country. And they began calling for a way of testing anyone who enters the country to see if they support the Constitution, the American way of life, and our government. And eventually, it didn't happen right away after Haymarket. It took a couple of decades leading up to the assassination of President McKinley. So finally, in I think it was 1903, a law was passed to keep anarchists out of the country. And I see parallels with what the Trump administration is talking about doing today, with trying to have some sort of way of blocking people who are radical Islamists from entering the U.S. But it all comes down to this challenging, difficult question of how would you even test someone to really see what's in their heart and in their mind to see if they, you know, support the American way of life. How do you define that? So back in the 1800s after Haymarket, there was efforts at it, but, you know, they never really came up with a system of doing that.
The sort of central questions around the story, whether it's the meaning of the bombing or the reaction to immigrant communities, or whether or not people can be held accountable not for what they do per se, but what they say in certain incidents, these are all issues that are very resonant in the contemporary moment.
Yeah. So it's sort of 131 years ago, and we're still having some of these same conversations. I want to thank Paul DiRica, public historian, director of programs at Illinois Humanities, Chicago-based writer, journalist Robert Lorzel, has a great story he did about this for WBEZ. We'll tweet that link out if anyone wants to go further into this history. Paul, Robert, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. And thank you for listening. This week, The 21st celebrates 1 year of being live on the air every day. We're taking a few minutes every day this week to reflect back on the past year and check in with each of our partner stations across the state. I'm joined now by R.C. McBride. He's general manager of our partner station, WGLT, in Bloomington Normal. Hey, R.C., welcome to The 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to, Nyla. Hard to believe that it's been a year. And think about what has happened in the past year.
Yeah, nothing's happened in the past year in this country, has it?
Not at all.
This is kind of fun for me to do this and share my conversations with general managers and folks on air. I think you and I, and as I have with all of our partner stations, I've had a lot of off-air conversations with you guys. But what I wanted to share with the whole state who's listening now is, why do you think it's important for people in the Bloomington Normal area to take part in conversations, issues that affect the entire state of Illinois?
Well, I don't think the timing could be any better for a show like the 21st than what we've had, given everything that is happening at a state level. And the fact is, and we hear a lot from Illinois Public Radio, and obviously we at GLT contribute to that as well. So there has been traditionally news coverage coming out of Springfield and coming out of Chicago and other areas that impact the entire state. But I still think this idea of a talk show focused on statewide issues fills a hole very nicely that wasn't there. We have our local show in Sound Ideas, and obviously we do a lot of local content during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And of course we have quite a few national talk shows, whether that's Tom Ashbrook or even our news magazines in the morning and afternoon, but nothing that was really kind of state-oriented. And I think this really fits that gap very well.
I wanted to play a portion of the 21st that aired last September as we're looking back on the year and thinking about our conversations. We were learning about the Human Library Project at Illinois State University. This is where people sign up to share their stories in person, their human books, to first-year students. And we spoke with one of the participants, Aaron Watson. He's an office manager at the University College at ISU. He's a Human Library book volunteer. And we asked him what he shares with his students.
I talk about my own personal experiences with, I have a malformed brain. My brain is a different shape than most people's, and I had a lot of struggles with it. I was diagnosed with it when I was 24. The condition that I have, called a Chiari malformation, affects any of your autonomic functions.
Wow.
So body temperature, heart rate, breathing, anything that you just normally take for granted, you suddenly notice because it's not working in sync as it used to.
What kind of questions have people asked you?
Part of my story, a big chunk of my story, I talk a lot about depression. And I was so young when I was diagnosed and had so many physical problems for many, many years that I became very severely depressed and even had thoughts of suicide. And these are good things to talk about with students, talk openly about it and how I found counseling and got over it. And they have a lot of questions about the emotional issues involved.
That's Aaron Watson. He's a Human Library book volunteer at ISU in Normal. We're remembering that conversation we had with him last September as we look back on our first year of being on the air daily. My guest right now is R.C. McBride. He's the general manager of WGLT. When I think about R.C., that conversations about that we've had, I'm thinking about the new birth center in Bloomington Normal. We've had reporters from the Bloomington Pantograph on in your studio where they join us to talk about the heroin epidemic in central Illinois. And I wonder, as we think about all of those things, as the general manager of WGLT, what are the issues that are really important to you and you think to the community?
Well, I'd like to think that we listen enough to our users and to our community that we allow those folks to dictate to us what those important issues are. And there are a lot of them, and you've mentioned some of them right there. And you overlay that the state budget impasse, which is ongoing, as you're very well aware, and its impact in so many sectors of our lives and how it touches so many people day to day. It's really this massive ongoing story. And I feel that sometimes we're only just scratching the surface of how that is impacting people that we know, ourselves as well, every single day. So I have to say that it's a very general answer, I grant you, but I really think that's the big one.
And when we think about the 21st being a platform for people across the state to come together, I wonder if there's anything particular you'd want listeners who are not from the Bloomington area, the Bloomington Normal area, to know about the cities, the surrounding communities.
Well, at risk of sounding too prideful and putting on my Bloomington Normal Convention Visitors Bureau hat, it's really a great place. And I, as you're aware, I'm an Illinois person. I've lived in various parts of the state in my life, and this is a community that I have fallen in love with. And you hear the story so many times. I came to Bloomington Normal to work at State Farm or to work at Country or to attend Illinois State or Illinois Wesleyan, and then I never imagined that this would become home, and it has. And that really seems to be a theme, and I know that's true other areas as well, but that's really, I think we have a very special place here, and it's one that we're very proud of, and we'd like folks to know about that.
You only go back to Chicago for Cubs games, right, RC?
Cubs games, occasionally museum, see some friends, right. But yes, plenty of Cubs games.
As we look forward to next year, apart from perhaps the Cubs going back to the World Series, I don't know if you want to make any predictions about that right now.
I've seen one more than I ever thought I would live to see.
There you go. Well, I did want to ask you a more serious question about what you think the issues are that are foremost on the minds of people in the Bloomington Normal area over the coming year.
Well, again, I just go back to the budget impasse, because as it continues to impact people, we all know it's not getting better. And the longer this goes on, the more and more it hurts people in their daily lives. And also, the deeper and deeper our hole as a state gets. And also, the worse and worse our reputation is among the other states in the union. So that, I imagine, you know, meet the old boss, same as the old boss, just change story. And I think it's going to be much the same moving forward as it has been in the past. And I know that's frustrating. And I know you love Illinois, the entire state. And that's difficult, I think, for a lot of us to see this happening. And certainly I don't have the answers. Certainly you and I talking about it can't fix it. But I think we can raise some awareness. And maybe that awareness will create enough interest and maybe enough pressure that something can be done about it.
No, you're right, and that's a good point. I mean, that's why we do what we do every day at the 21st. I think with the budget impasse, we spend a lot of time talking, our team, the producers, you know, meeting with, talking, or the interactions that we have with audiences, whether they are the folks in Bloomington Normal. Thank you. You're always really good about emailing and reaching out to me personally. But we do really think about, particularly when it comes to the budget impasse, how we can make people be more informed about the situation. You know, when I think about polls that show from last fall, 2/3 of people in Illinois saying that they're not affected by it and they don't know, really feel like they have any impact from it. You know, we know that there are people that are affecting it. Everybody, as long as you're a taxpayer, as long as you live here, you're being affected by the budget impasse. So I appreciate that. RC McBride is the general manager of WGLT and Bloomington Normal, one of our partner stations for the 21st as we celebrate our first year anniversary this week. Hey, RC, it's been great to speak with you. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
It has been such a great compliment for what we're trying to do here, and I know other stations feel that way, and I know it's only going to get better from here. Congratulations on a great first year, and here's to many more.
And we go, because we are very fair on the 21st about sports teams, from a Cubs fan, that is RC McBride, to the biggest Sox fan on the 21st team. Steve Mark is with me. He is an engineer. We are going behind the scenes all this week as we celebrate our one-year anniversary. I wanted to introduce you all to the voices you don't get to hear every day, but who are part of making this show on the air every day. Hey, Steve, thanks for being
here. I think I'm the only White Sox fan here in general.
Maybe you are the only White Sox fan in the Champaign-Urbana area.
That's not a surprise.
Okay. Can you explain to everybody what you do as an engineer?
For the show itself, I help produce all the billboards and promos.
The billboards are that 1 minute.
The 1 minute before the newscast.
Before the newscast, yes.
I do all of those every day.
And the promos are all the commercials everyone hears when we say what's coming up. You produce all of that.
Correct. I help with the pre-interviews with guests that are pre-taped sometimes. Sometimes I direct the show, and if Jason's out.
Yeah, what does it mean to direct the show?
So I'm the one that sits behind an audio board and makes the show go, essentially.
Right. And I like how you say that as if it's really not that much, but there's a lot going on.
There is a lot going on. There's a lot of buttons to push and levels to check and everything.
And really? I never do any of that. Yeah. I just sit in front of a microphone.
We make you sound good.
Yes, you and all of the guests, not just me, everyone who comes on the air. When there's pieces of tape that we have to play, when we are bringing in phone calls or guests from other studios, that all happens because of you monitoring a massive board. We will tweet out a picture of the board so everyone can see that. As I've been talking to folks about this past year, Steve, I wanted to ask you, what are your most memorable moments?
There's a lot. From conversations with mentors and mentorees to kids in Rantoul and Danville to one I picked in particular was going to the State House in Springfield. It was an opportunity that we could make because we had the equipment to do it finally, and we went to Springfield, and this is a little bit of what happened when we were there.
Today we've taken the program to directly inside the State House in Springfield. As you can hear the buzz around me in the South Hall, everyone's getting ready for Governor Rauner. Thanks for tuning in to our special live broadcast of the 21st. Today we're inside the State Capitol building. Within the hour, Governor Rauner will be... You're listening to a special edition of the 21st. That noise in the background is because we're inside the State Capitol building. And all of that happened because of folks like Steve Mork. Steve, you were running the broadcast that day.
I was, and I was breathing in your ear the whole entire time.
You were.
So I still apologize for that.
You were breathing in my ear, and everyone was talking in my ear as I was on the air talking to everybody. Yes, I will not forget that. That happened. What do you think? I wonder, as you're thinking about that, why do you think it was so important for us to do that, to do this broadcast? Because there's a lot of technical stuff involved that people don't think about. We had to set up... We basically set up a table in the hallway, and then through the miracle of modern technology, are able to do the show live from there.
Well, one of the things I like so much about radio is it's very portable, and for us to be able to go to the State House and talk to the people that are going to be there and the people that matter for passing a budget, because it was before Rauner's budget address, to show our audience that these are the people that you voted for, and these are the people that are making decisions for you. And we're here getting their voice to you so you can tell them how to do their job, really, because that's one of the things that we do that I really like, that journalism does, is to give a voice to politicians and leaders, to the people, so the people know what to do, really.
Yeah, to be a conduit for that.
Correct.
I think it is interesting when we do the broadcast in Springfield because not that many people do that anymore. And my experience has been, one of the reasons I really wanted to push for the show to do those was because I think lawmakers even appreciate it, because not very many people even have the resources to be broadcasting from the state capitol or other places anymore.
And those are busy people. They're very busy people, obviously.
They are. So if you go right there when they're walking by, it's a lot easier to talk to them, too.
Right.
Yes, that's true. Do you have any questions for me?
I do. The one thing that I've always wondered, and I wonder about a lot of people that work in journalism, is why they do it or where they got their start. So my question for you is, why do you do what you do?
Oh, that's a really good question, Steve. This is kind of fun. I told everybody they could ask me a question too, to explain to all of you who are listening. I fell in love with public radio when I was a newspaper reporter in Miami, and I worked for the public radio station in Miami at WLRN. And for me, I think there's just really something about people's voices and connecting to our voices that we establish an emotional relationship with. And I think that we can tell so much from someone's voice. We can tell if they're happy or they're sad, or as you could hear from in Springfield, I had a cold that day. Not to joke about it, but I do think you can tell a lot from a person's voice. I think that conveys a lot. And I've thought a lot about this, obviously. I think listening to people's voices is an intimate thing that also activates a really important part of our brain and our imagination in a way that engages us with journalism that I don't think happens, for example, if you're looking at a television screen. And so that's why I love public media. And I think that we create that intimate space. We have an opportunity to give voice, as you said, not just to politicians. Of course, that's a really important part of our job, being that conduit. You know, I'm thinking about even this week, you know, talking to people like Senator Duckworth and being able to ask questions that her constituents want to hear and hear about the bill that she passed about transportation infrastructure that's going to bring more jobs to Illinois. Those are all really important things. But as you mentioned, the conversations, when we think about conversations with Warren, that mentoring student, when we hear an ability to put voices to other people that don't get a chance to have that amplification is why I do what I do. I love having those conversations with people. I think that everyone has a story to tell. I think you just have to ask the right questions. And I consider it a privilege that I get to do this every day, that everybody out there is listening, and that I get to do this with you too, Steve.
And I find a privilege to do it with you too.
Oh, that's very kind. And that wraps up our show for today. Thanks so much to all of you for listening. As always, you can find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. Those are things Steve does too. He puts all of this stuff in the podcast. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to connect with us is all at our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Christine Herman and Alan Montecilio. Engineering and technical direction from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.